Zähne und die trägt er im Gesicht. Und mein Kiesner hat ein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht. An einem schönen blauen Sonntag liegt ein toter Mann am Strand.
Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. That was La Dolina from the Three Penny Opera, which happened to be playing at the Theatre de Lys on Christopher Street in New York City when Ellen Thurston began her career. Ellen, of course, is my guest this month. After the interview, Gold and Fizdale playing Brahms Variations on a theme by Haydn for two pianos, four hands. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I'm here at VCB Art Gallery with E.T., better known as Ellen Thurston. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you.
So nice to see you on that side of the microphone.
Well, thank you for asking me to come and sit on this side of the microphone. I'm hoping I may prefer it to the other side. I don't know. When I told people that you were going to interview me, they said, about what? I said, I have no idea.
Well, where to begin? I'm sure there's plenty to talk about. We could start with this. How did you end up in Hudson?
Oh, that's the way a lot of people end up here, through friends. I had a house on the other side of the river between Kingston and Woodstock, and friends of mine got a weekend house in Churchtown. And we thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if I had a house on that road, Churchtown to Conic Road. And it's a beautiful, beautiful spot. Wouldn't it be fun? We could garden together and, you know, all of this. And all of us were still living in New York. Anyway, I was up here through friends. I had a house on the other side of the river between Kingston and Woodstock. And friends of mine got a weekend house in Churchtown. And we thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if I had a house on that road, Churchtown to Conic Road. And it's a beautiful, beautiful spot. Wouldn't it be fun? We could garden any more time here. Joan Davidson moved to the area. Mike Gladstone, my friend, moved here. And Mike was involved with the Hudson Opera House, and he asked if I would be on the advisory board. That they were just beginning. I mean, they'd formed a corporation and they had bought the building, but then they had to decide how they were going to manage it all. And then I began to spend more time here and really began to like it better than the other side of the river. There's nothing wrong with the other side of the river. It's just there's more cleared land here. It's farmland, and the Catskills are kind of rough, and it's different kinds of trees than here. I mean, it's different.
You grew up in Binghamton.
Well, in a little town called Kirkwood, which is just outside, yes.
And is that a similar kind of terrain to Columbia County?
To a certain extent, there's a lot of rolling farmland, and I grew up in a little, you know, little village. I grew up next to the railroad tracks, and now I live in Hudson, and I live next to the railroad tracks. In both instances, I'm on the right side of the tracks. At least we thought we were. But I'm used to the sound of train.
Then, from Kirkwood, you went to college in Binghamton.
Well, it wasn't actually in Binghamton. It was in Endicott. And my father was working at IBM, which kind of started out in Endicott. It was very early days. You know, they started out making punch card computers. And it was during that era. And so I lived at home and rode every morning to Endicott with my father. And that's how I went to college. It was quite interesting that the college opened up just as I had graduated from high school and didn't know what to do with myself and contemplated going to the community college that was nearby. But then the state university took over a branch of Syracuse University, which was in Endicott. And so my plan was to, because I wanted to get a degree in journalism, and my plan was to go a couple of years to the community college and then transfer to Syracuse, but I never did do that. I got involved in other things. So.
And then by this time, this Endicott College was actually the beginnings of SUNY Binghamton.
That's right. It's called Harper College, H-A-R-P-U-R, and I have a great fondness for Alexander Hamilton because he went to Columbia University, which I think was the first college established in the United States. And I went to Columbia University for a master's degree. And the college, Harper College, is named after Alexander Hamilton's mathematics teacher, Robert Harper. So, you know, there are not 6 degrees of separation. I'm sure there are only one or two.
You got your master's degree in what field?
Theater.
And also the BA?
No, the BA, well, I had a double major, theater and literature. You know, it was a liberal arts education there, and it was just starting we were the first class to graduate 4 years from this branch of the state university.
And so then you went to Columbia and studied theater.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your particular interest in theater?
Acting.
Acting.
Yes.
So did you...
I got nowhere. Well, I stayed on in New York, and of course it's... Instead of being a big wig and a big frog in a small pond, suddenly it's the other way around. And, you know, there are all these girls auditioning, much prettier than me, very talented, obviously. But I had to earn a living while I was there.
So what did you do then to start earning a living?
Well, I actually did work backstage at the theater. I worked at the Theatre de Lys. It's now the Lucille Lortel Theater, I think.
And back in the day, it was the theater that had the Threepenny Opera.
That's right. And the Threepenny Opera, I think, was in its 7th and 8th year when I worked in the box office. Not the actual box office, but I took ticket orders over the phone. And I did that for a year. And then I got a job with a theatrical lawyer. I mean, we had a theatrical practice. So I did income tax preparation for various movie stars and things. You know, it was a little touch with fame. I spoke to Marlon Brando on the phone once. It wasn't much of a conversation.
But still, Marlon Brando.
Said, Mr. Brando, he said yes. I said, please hold for Jay Julian. And that was it. The end of the conversation. But it was, you know, in those days, a little girl from upstate New York could find a semi-glamorous job for not much money. But it was New York. I mean, it was exciting.
And so how long did you do that?
5 years. And I think, I mean, it was just, he was a single practitioner. He was, you know, it was one lawyer and me. And when I think back on it, I think I was probably what you call a paralegal. Because he would say, pull out that contract for so-and-so and turn this into a contract. You always learn something on every job.
Was that also in the theater district?
No, it was near Grand Central. But, you know, we handled, as their manager, say 10 actors and actresses. So it was, you know, it was pretty exciting.
And from there, did you go to the Arts Council?
The State Arts Council, right. And it was in its pretty much its early stages as well. It had actually been in existence as a branch of the executive part of the government. In other words, it worked out of the governor's office. So it had a lot of protection. And we learned later when we were turned in more into a state agency than a darling of the governor, that life would be different.
Now, was that Governor Rockefeller?
It was. It was. Governor Rockefeller has two legacies, as far as I'm concerned. And one is the State University of New York, which he put together, and the State Arts Council. So I took advantage of both. And all the time I was a Democrat, which was living in upstate New York. I was a Republican for years because everybody I knew was a Republican.
By today's standards, Governor Rockefeller would be a Democrat. In fact, kind of a left-leaning Democrat.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what did you do there?
I started out working in what was called the Performing Arts Touring Program, where we gave grants to organizations, primarily in upstate New York, to be able to hire outside artists to come and perform. It was, you know, we funded arts councils, museums, all kinds, and theaters all over the state.
Now, where was your office? In the city?
My office was in New York. We had an office in New York, and there was an office in Syracuse, because one of the staff people from the very beginning in a high-up position was Bill Hull, who happened to live in Syracuse. And they thought it was good to have a presence upstate, so they let him establish an office there.
And so at first you were doing this theatrical touring thing.
Oh, yeah. And then one day I decided that, now, how did this happen? I started what I called a house organ, you know, a house organ is, because I thought that the staff, we were a small staff of maybe 20 people at that point, and one program didn't know what the other program was doing because we had, you know, it was organized by discipline. So there was visual arts and there was performing arts and there were special projects and educational projects. And no one knew what anyone was doing. And curiously, we never had staff meetings. So I started this house organ and it was mostly sort of jokes and satire and things of that sort, to get people to read it was my theory. And Dorothy Rogers, Richard Rogers' wife, was a member of the council itself at that time, and she called it Ellen's Newspaper. Anyway, people really liked it. And then our executive director, John Hightower, got the proofs for the annual report, which he did out of his office. And someone needed to proofread it. And he gave it to me as he thought the most logical person since I had started this house organ. And his wife, who had Carolyn Hightower, who up to that point had also been involved in helping him produce the annual report, taught me proofreading symbols and said, you know, they're all in the back of Webster's dictionary, you can find them, but these are the ones you really need to know. And so I sat down and proofed it, and they were impressed somehow by what I did, and he he gave me a new position that was much higher up from, oh, before that, though, when the touring program director was a man named Omar Lerman. And when he left, my boss, John Hightower, said nothing to me about, well, we're going to be searching for someone new or anything like that. And one day, I don't know where I got the gumption to do this. Anyway, I steeled myself and walked into his office and said, I know what will happen. You'll hire somebody. I will teach him all about the job and what has to be done. And then I will go back to being his secretary. So he said, okay, I'm going to call you the publications associate. And here's the, you know, this all happened around the same time. And then I went up the ladder a bit. I was there 11 years. It's interesting, though, because some of my best friends came from that period when I was working at the council. And whenever we get together, and we've had a few sort of reunions, and we call ourselves the originals, because at the time we were all there in the 60s and the early 70s, we didn't have a clue how to what an arts council should do. And we just sort of made it up. And we were given leeway to do that, which was quite amazing when you think about it.
I suppose it was one of the first state arts councils.
It was, I think, the first one that had significant funding. And, you know, the way in which the funding was handed out has changed over the years a lot. But we established peer panels, so if you were a dance company coming to us to look for funds to keep going, you would be judged, your application would be seen by other people working in dance companies who knew dance and knew what the problems were. And that kind of peer look at what you're doing is often challenged because they say, oh, well, if you're on the panel, you probably get a grant right away. But there were lots of safeguards toward that kind of, I guess you would call it conflict of interest, wouldn't you? And through the years, when we went from, I think, $18 million a year to some $35 million in one giant leap, and along with this giant leap came restrictions, in a sense, where we had to spend 50% of the money on what was called primary organizations without anyone defining what that meant. And it meant, of course, the Metropolitan Museum and you know, down the ladder to historical societies, for example. But we had to spend 50% on primaries, and 50% had to be divided throughout smaller organizations. And I can't remember exactly how that worked. A percentage based on population, I think is the way it was earmarked for every county in the state, 62 counties. I established a library at the Arts Council, because every program kept their files and whatever they had of interest close to the vest, because they were afraid it would get lost if it was in some giant something or other. And this was an era where computers were just now beginning to take over our lives, so to speak. But we were not computerized in any way. And so we had to go through that struggle. My department got bigger and bigger because it was promotion, you know, which meant we had to go out and do seminars on how to fill out with your application and that kind of thing. And I started a little newsletter. I mean, there were various things of that nature. And I was in charge at that point of all the publications. So I realized I've always been in the information business. And I started then, when I decided I'd been there long enough, which was 11 and a half years, that I would start this organization called the Center for Arts Information, which was one of those organizations that is kind of comes out of an agency like the Arts Council. So it has close ties to the agency. Yet it is a nonprofit organization that is free of the agency. In Europe, in England anyway, they call them quangos, a quasi-autonomous non-governmental organization. And it's always a difficult connection between the agency and a quango, because if the agency gives money to the quango, it thinks it, you know, can tell it what to do, can own it. And then the quango can say, but we're a nonprofit organization and we don't have to do what you tell us. So that's the position we found ourselves in. And from there, I became a regional representative at the National Endowment for the Arts, which I did for 3 years, which meant traveling. I had the Mid-Atlantic states, the New England states, and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands were all part of my territory.
That's a nice place to travel.
Yeah, not bad.
And so you were visiting with various arts organizations.
Yeah, and spreading the word and, you know, going to lots of seminars and various things. And it was fine until I just felt I couldn't travel anymore, get on another airplane. And the thing is, when you're traveling, it all sounds very glamorous, right? But you come home and you call your friend and say, hey, you want to go for dinner tonight? They've already made plans. And so you feel like you're forgotten. One day, I think I was in Pittsburgh. No, I wasn't in Pittsburgh. I was home, and I woke up, and I said, I'm not going to open my eyes till I can figure out where I am. And I didn't know I was at home. I thought I was in Pittsburgh. I still obviously think I'm in Pittsburgh.
So that convinced you that there was enough of this?
It was time to, yeah. And then from there, I became, like all unemployed people, I became a consultant.
To arts organizations.
Yeah, primarily.
Huh. And so all this time you were still living in Manhattan.
Right.
And when did you start going to the country?
Well, if you live in New York, especially in Manhattan, you do have to have a place where that you can escape to lead a civilized life. And as I told you, I had this house in between Kingston and Woodstock for quite a while, and it was a real weekend place. And when I came here, I was on my last, started out as a consultancy and then turned into a job and working for the City of New York, the Department of Business Services. And when I first went there, I was running a tourism grant program that was funded by a special hotel tax, like a lodging tax, as Hudson has now. And from there, they had me writing, well, we wrote a pamphlet on, I don't know, the 76 rules you have to comply with if you're going to open a restaurant. Something, it's not 76, I don't know what it is. It's a lot. And then I was writing reports that went to the mayor and to the city council. And really what it was taking the reports of all the subgroups that were within the agency and putting it together in a report and making it sound like one voice. It was all done by computer. They would send me the report and by computer, and I would move things around and edit it and that was it. I said, I can do this from upstate. No, they didn't want me to. And at that point, it was 4 days a week, and I went down to 3 days a week. And at that point, I was clearly ensconced in Hudson. So I finally moved here, full time.
And so then you were on the advisory board for the Opera House.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you start becoming involved in politics?
Oh, dear. I'm trying to think what year it would have been. It was when Linda Mussman ran for mayor, I think. And would that have been before or after the battle with St. Lawrence Cement that wanted to build the largest?
I think that was actually before, wasn't it, that she first ran?
It probably was. I think so. And the first time I ran for alderman in the city of Hudson, and I lost by significant number of votes. I mean, now, you know, a lot of people lose by one vote, two votes. I think mine was 30. And then I, you know, stuck with it. And the next year, a number of us sort of swept into office that year. The Democrats kind of moved in. So I had three terms as an alderman.
And then did you go directly to the county?
Yes, I became a county supervisor.
And you're still a supervisor?
No, I ran unopposed, which is always quite wonderful, you know. You don't have to work very hard. But in another way, it's bad because you don't go out and knock on doors and meet your constituents as eagerly as you did when you were actually running against someone else. And that way you're out of touch with your constituents if you don't, you know, aren't out among the people. But two terms was quite enough. I was ready to quit.
And all this time, you've stayed connected with the Opera House?
I went on the board pretty quickly after I moved here full time, as I recall. The Opera House bylaws, you can only be on the board for a certain number of years, and then you have to get off. You can go on again if they ask you to after a certain amount of time away. So I don't know all the number of years that covers, but I moved here full-time, I'd say, in 1995. So I've been connected with the Opera House for 20 years.
Now, in 1995, did you ever imagine Hudson would be what it is today?
Well, you know, no, I loved it from the very beginning. And it's, as we all know, very easy to get connected through any number of ways. People are eager to see someone new and, you know, glom onto them and say, oh, we've got a spot for you. When the St. Lawrence Cement brought a lot of people together and a lot of people sort of became much more active through that fight, I guess you would call it.
Sort of a common cause.
Yeah. And from there, all other things kind of started to happen. But what's happened recently is that there's so much work to be done here, and you know, infrastructure is a real problem, and all the parks and the waterfront and the bridge and everything seems to be, you know, ripe for improvement at this point. But I have a lot of hope about Hudson because suddenly there are all these organizations like Promise Neighborhood, Kite's Nest, the Sloop Club, Perfect 10, all of these organizations that are meant to improve life for families and children. And it's quite wonderful to watch. We didn't have, our energy was a different kind of energy, I think. And it's still there. And there are a lot of new people and they're, you know, getting involved much more quickly than we did. I would say, when I say we, people who came around the same time as I did.
Which at that time, I think, was probably a fairly close-knit group.
Yeah, and it still is in some ways. I mean, that's why people don't like change, because, you know, everybody wants it to be exactly what they, you know, when they first saw it, they wanted it to be.
And so then, at some point, you started Ellen's Picks.
Oh, I did. I started that. I went back to look at this the other day. Well, you call it Ellen's Picks. I I've since given it a name which a lot of people don't seem to understand and can never remember. Much to do about Hudson. To do having several meanings in this instance, but no one sees that. Anyway, in 2005, I think it was, during the St. Lawrence Cement fight, I started going to meetings in the Common Council chambers. And it seems like every time I went, there was something that was really important that was taken up. You never know what's going to happen. And people should have been there to hear this and see it. So I thought people should go to meetings. Everybody needs to go to meetings. They just need to see what happens. They need to listen to the chatter in the anteroom before the meeting starts. There, you need to see the body language of the people in the council talking to each other. So that's how Ellen's Picks, as you say, the events, I added later. I thought, oh, while I'm doing this, I might as well say, don't forget that such and such is happening at the waterfront on Saturday night. And it just kept growing and growing a lot, yeah.
To the point where now you have several hundred subscribers, I suppose.
I have more like, I think it's 1,200. A lot of realtors tell people about the list. And for those who don't know, it's a list of events that happen in any given week that I send by email because I want it to like land in somebody's inbox. Then I have to go someplace else to find it. But that has its problems too, so.
Now, if people want to get on the list, how do they do that?
They just ask to be put on the list.
They just email you, someone mm-hmm. get your address.
And, yeah.
It's quite essential. I mean, not only for the meetings, but also to if you want to go to the movies or something and you just see what's around.
Yeah, it's interesting because I never know what effect it has. And so when people say, oh, I love your list, I say, well, do you read it? And they say, oh, yes, I wait for it eagerly. I said, does it influence you to go to anything? And they say, yes. So that keeps me going because, you know, you put something out there and you don't have any idea what happens to. But I meet people really quite often telling me that they appreciate it and that they really do look forward to getting it.
No, I think people depend on it. If a gallery is having an opening or something like that, they like to know that it's being publicized.
Right, right. And some people say, you know, I just want to know what's happening. And I think they think that our local newspapers don't quite do the job, maybe. And they think of my list as a curated list. But it's not, it's too long, really, to be called a curated list. I try to stay away from chicken dinners and that sort of thing. They sneak in occasionally. But there's so many good causes around and fundraising events that most of them are, you know, really quite wonderful and people have a good time.
It is compact. I mean, maybe it's gotten longer or more
more difficult.
More difficult.
More difficult to get out on
it's
time.
More difficult to do. But it's also a lot of information in a small place.
Well, I organize it chronologically by date. The Columbia paper, I think, organizes it by discipline. So it's all dance, all music, all theater, grouped in that way. My feeling is that what a person using this list really wants to know is what's happening on Saturday night when my friends are coming and they'll want to, you know, go out, and where should we go? What can we do?
Right, that is an advantage that it's by date.
It's the way I would like to have it. So, you know, you're stuck with it, I guess.
I suppose everybody lets you know what they're doing. I mean,
pretty much. I go on a number of websites as well, because not everybody tells me. And yeah, I get a lot of email. And every once in a while, I think, why am I still doing this?
You must put quite a bit of time into it.
It takes a long time, and I need to, I'm about to, I hope, have a different system of getting it into people's inboxes, because I need to go to MailChimp or something like that, because Verizon would shut me down, because they had rules about how many emails you can send in an hour, how many addresses can be in any email, and they'll just shut you down and send you an email saying, we've shut you down, unless you can prove to us that you're not spam. That's one thing. Or if you've, you know, gone over your limit. So because this drove me crazy, I switched to Gmail. Gmail's just as bad, if not worse. So it's driving me to do what I should have done a long time ago. Services that, like MailChimp, that I think must have some kind of arrangement with the powers that be, whoever they might be, the Verizons of this world, where they can bypass, maybe in some way, these restrictions. I'm not sure.
But now you do this all on a volunteer basis.
Yes, it's a public service.
Well, you've been sort of a public servant all along.
Thank you. Oh, I'm also on the radio station, you know. I don't know if that's a public service or not.
Yeah, you do the weekly afternoon show, two hours on Thursdays.
That's right. It's been a lot of fun, I must say.
Well, it was fun when we did it together.
That's right. We did do it together. I've always said I feel like I'm playing at radio. You know, it shouldn't be that much fun. Should be more professional. But it's a great station, and I think it's doing a great job of serving all the different populations that we have in Columbia and Greene counties.
So, and in a way, it's gone full circle. It's a sort of form of journalism.
Yeah, I think about that every once in a while. I love movies about journalists. I think I'm Katharine Hepburn or somebody. I don't know. It's just the same as when I lived in upstate New York as a teenager and saw all those movies of girls going to New York and, you know, being successful at something or other.
When you were first there, did you make the rounds to do auditions and all that?
I did to a certain extent, but I didn't get very far. As I said, I had to earn a living. And then I learned years later that people would work at some job for a certain number of weeks till they could go on unemployment. I never thought of going on unemployment. I could have been a big star.
If you'd only been a bit more opportunistic.
Oh, well, maybe it's not too late.
Well, Ellen, I think it's getting to the time where you told me you were going to have to be...
Sprung loose.
But this has certainly been very interesting. I've learned all sorts of things.
Thank you. Really? I hope I didn't talk too much and give away any secrets that I shouldn't have.
No.
Good.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking with you.